I want to talk about the most pressing urban environmental health and equity challenges in low and middle income nations. I want to look at the huge scale of the environmental health inequities. Which are the most serious? Which can we act on, and how? You'll also be surprised to get advice in this talk on how to get proposals for marriage, and also how to get a cheap retirement home, but this is to come. We get some dramatic examples of differentials. There's a 500-fold difference in the price paid for water, the price paid for water per litre. And of course, the cheapest water is the water that the middle and upper income groups get because they've got water piped to their homes. The most expensive water per litre is that paid for by those that are most peripheral, those that are poorest, those that are furthest away from the mains. For instance, if you lived in Kibera, this enormous informal settlement in Nairobi, you're paying 10, 20, 30 times more than the rich Nairobiites. The most extreme price was actually paid by an informal settlement on the edge of Luanda, served by tankers. Now, if those people got enough water for health, it would cost them several thousand dollars a year. There's many other dramatic inequalities. There's a 30 to 40-fold difference in under 5 mortality rates, in the proportion of children that die before the age of 5. 30 to 40-fold difference. Most of that is explained by the quality of the home, the neighborhood, the environment. There's at least a 50 to 100-fold difference in the space per person in housing. In Mumbai, I work with slum dwellers, shack dwellers, homeless groups. Many of them are living in homes with less than 1 square meter per person. Less than 1 square meter per person. And then if we take greenhouse gas emissions as generating extreme risk, and generating extreme risk that's going to increase exponentially, we look at these enormous differences. The wealthiest 2% of the world generate 1,000 times more greenhouse gas emissions per person than the poorest 2%. But it's always difficult to know, are we focusing on poverty or are we focusing on inequality? If we're interested in the most pressing environmental health problems, then we focus on low-income groups. We focus on those living in informal settlements. We can actually ignore higher income groups in most cities because they have very good environmental health. But if our interest is in equity, you have to look at both ends of the spectrum. But is the spectrum the planet? 3.5 billion urban dwellers. Is the spectrum nations, the extremes within Canada, within Burkina Faso? Or is it the extremes within cities? Here is a picture of an informal settlement in Buenos Aires, close to the main railway station, Retiro. Now, if we're interested in environmental health, we're interested in the settlement in the foreground. If we're interested in equity, we're interested in the comparison between the environmental health in the foreground and the wealthier groups in the background. I'm particularly interested in informal or illegal settlements, sometimes classified as slums, sometimes classified as shanty towns. They have a quarter of the world's urban population. They have over an eighth of the world's total population. Many of the cities I work in, 30%, 50%, 60% of the population live in informal settlements. In Nairobi, over half live in informal settlements. In Mumbai, over half live in informal settlements. Mumbai is a very successful city, a very wealthy city. So informal settlements aren't a characteristic of very poor cities necessarily. Dar es Salaam, 65% living in informal settlements. All have deficiencies in what we take for granted. Water pipe to your home, toilets in your home that work, housing that doesn't fall down every time there's a cyclone, tenure, protection from eviction, drainage. Astonishing health differentials if we view the differentials internationally, the worst being in the informal settlements in the periphery very often, the best being where we live. Astonishing local differentials between those living in informal settlements and the people living a mile away, 2 miles away, 3 miles away. And of course, the local differentials in environmental health are much lower in high-income nations. However bad conditions are for low-income groups in Canada, almost all live in homes that have water piped there. Almost all live in homes, however inadequate, that have a toilet. And I show this picture and people think that this is the exception. This isn't the exception. This is the norm. This is how most urban dwellers are being housed in Africa, much of Asia, and much of Latin America. This is actually in Manila. So let's look at differentials for one city. And I'm taking under five mortality rates because it's a very good measure of the quality of housing, of income, of nutrition, of everything that contributes to good health. And we look at Nairobi, and it's pretty shocking. You know, 60 kids under five die before, per thousand of the population die before the age of five. It's even worse in other urban areas. It's even worse in rural areas. Now, look at that and you think, okay, Nairobi is actually doing rather well. This is the average for the informal settlements. 150 child deaths per thousand births. Nearly three times the average for Nairobi. If we go to Kibera, perhaps the best known informal settlement in Nairobi, it's close to 200. That's almost one in five. If we go to Embakasi, the informal settlement with the worst performance on under five mortality rates, it's one child in four is dying. We don't have statistics for the wealthy in Nairobi, but my guess is that they'd be about there, about eight, about 10. Look at the dramatic differentials, and this is within one city. We can look at the differentials, too, in the urban population of different states in India. The blue columns are the poorest quartile. The red are the rest of the population. Look at Delhi. Delhi is a very wealthy, successful city. And yet the poorest quartile are still suffering under five mortality rates, close to 80. But then we've got to think, inequality in what? I think it's useful to distinguish between five particular categories. Obviously health, obviously wealth as the means by which you buy healthy living conditions. Obviously the material conditions that you can actually measure, the quality of housing, the quality of water, sanitation, drainage, solid waste collection, resilience to extreme weather. Also, the public entitlements and services, decent health care, education, a social wage, pension, rule of law. And then we can look at inequalities in voice, in social status. All these are important. All these contribute directly or indirectly to health. So I'm always asked to give policy-relevant messages, which I have great difficulty doing. I suppose that I'm too interested in too many things. So when I'm asked, what's the most pressing urban environmental health and equity challenge in low-income and middle-income nations, I say, you can't say. There's tens of thousands of urban centres. In India alone, there's 8,000, 9,000 urban centres. How can you generalise? Some urban centres in middle-income nations have very high environmental health standards. Porto Alegre, one of my favourite cities, has a life expectancy higher than many US cities. And how can we generalise when the health challenges differ by age group, by sex, by gender, by income level, by occupation, by district. In 1989, I was told that I had only 10 minutes on the podium, that I was addressing government delegations who were preparing for the UN Earth Summit in 1992. And they said, you've got to speak for 10 minutes. Don't give us all that stuff about how it's complex and how it's varied. We want the most pressing environmental health problem that governments should address as a priority for the Earth Summit. It's got to be policy relevant, and they've got to remember it. So I walked to the podium and explained that I'm very bad at generalizations, but I would give them a summary of the most serious environmental health problems. They were stunned. I've never been known to speak for 2 minutes and walk off a podium. And it's pretty accurate. There's nothing wrong with this as a summary. The beauty of this is that at least everyone remembered my presentation. In 1991, I was part of a World Health Organization commission on health and the environment. And it brought together really some of the most distinguished, prestigious health specialists in the world. It included Sir Richard Doll, who really is one of the most famous epidemiologists of the last 25 years. And as the commission began, Sir Richard put his hand up and said, I'm very shocked to see Dr. Satterthwaite is here. I believe that he's actually rapporteuring this meeting and he's writing the report. I heard that in 1989 he went to a conference and gave this summary of the most serious environmental harm. It is so inaccurate. Why do you allow him to be on this commission? What you've got to do is you've got to change the summary. I was grateful for Sir Richard Doll's sense of humour. This is a better summary, because it includes, obviously, fecal contamination of food, of water, of hands, of the environment. It also includes vector-borne diseases and the diseases that are not spread by water or food, the airborne, tuberculosis, acute respiratory infections, the vector-borne diseases, dengue, malaria. But, of course, you can move to a slightly more complete list, and this is, I think, a more complete list for the informal settlements I work in. All these are usually important in an informal settlement, but of course their relative importance varies for the population and for segments of that population. So it's important that this is a decent list, but you've got to look deeper. You're not surprised in seeing insufficient water. Very often insufficient water is as much of a health issue as contaminated water. No drains, no garbage collection, floods and landslides. Every city I go to, whenever there's floods and there's hilly areas, there's landslides that kill dozens or even hundreds of people, overcrowding. The list, I think, is obvious. And, of course, this is a mix of things. This is a mix of actual health hazards, fecal matter in water supplies, the immediate causes, the leaky pipes, and the factors that increase their health impact, no healthcare service to go to if your child or you are suffering from diarrheal diseases. And, of course, climate change is adding increasing risk levels from storms, from floods, from heat waves. And, of course, how the storms and the floods affect fecal contamination is one of the big issues. So if we're trying to make sense of all these determinants, we have to go from the global to the very local, to an increasingly globalized world economy, to me in my tiny shack, 1 square meter per person, as I try to bring up my children and protect them from health hazards. And I think it's useful to go through these different levels of differentials. Of course, health outcomes are affected by the prosperity of a nation, by the extent of private investment there. The prosperity of any nation or city is very much influenced by its place within the world economy. And we know there's dramatic differences in life expectancy or in under 5 mortality rates associated with nations' per capita incomes. Interesting outliers, there's some low-income nations that manage a very high life expectancy, very low infant and child mortality, and the other way around. But in general, increasing wealth does mean these health outcomes improve. But then, of course, for urban populations, it's what happens in the city that has so much influence. In the end, it's the city government that is responsible for most of the things that give you a decent, healthy environment: water, sanitation, drainage, usually healthcare, sometimes education, policing, the rule of law, voice. And it's local governments that urban poor organizations can generally influence most easily. So the quality and the capacity of local government is a critical influence on health. Then we get down to the local. And, of course, the national and the city determinants influence the quality of the physical environment, the housing size, the quality, the water, the sanitation, obviously access to healthcare services. What can we change? All those items in red are things we can change. We can de-link bad environmental health from low income. Indeed, any decent municipality, city, should be the primary player in de-linking low income from lousy health, lousy environment. This could actually be called the conventional urban development agenda. But then there's all these other complex, difficult factors, important factors. The extent to which individuals, households, and communities feel that they can act, that they can lobby, that they can make demands. The social support networks on which they draw. Recent migrants very often coming into a city lacking that social support network that is so important for avoiding disease and injury or coping with it. The exclusion of large sections of the population by income. Janice Perlman's recent book on 5 minutes, thank you. Janice Perlman's recent book on favela in Rio de Janeiro, how the status of living in a favela, living in an informal settlement, bars you from access to income earning opportunities and to many other things. These also we can change. If local government is very weak, we can actually work on the factors listed in red. But how can we support empowerment? How can we support the removal of discrimination? How can we support less inequity? I actually muddled up the words inequity in iniquity in a presentation recently, but maybe there's more between the two than we imagine. Aid agencies were not set up to support empowerment. There was a savings group in Harare, Zimbabwe, formed by 300 homeless women. They negotiated land from Harare municipality. All they needed was a loan for $18,000. No one would give it to them. It was too small an amount for most funders. Or it was urban, and many funding agencies won't fund urban. Which funders have the capacity to talk to listen to work with 300 homeless women as they organize, they mobilize, they get land, and they build their own homes? There's actually a huge potential to work with the organizations formed by the urban poor, but most of the funding organizations are not set up to do so. There's now national federations of slum dwellers or shack dwellers in more than 20 nations. Some of them are listed here. I'm not going to go through them, but for instance, in India, the National Slum Dwellers Federation of Mahila Milan. Mahila Milan is the federation of women savings groups, have over 2 million members. You know, these are substantial organizations. You'll be amused by the name of the South African Federation. It's called the Federation of the Urban Poor, and its acronym is FEDUP. All these federations are innovating around meeting needs. All have savings groups at their foundation. All have women in key roles. Just a reminder that these are mass movements. They want to work with local government. But if local government doesn't want to work with them, then they will adopt the more classic forms of protest. In 2001, we set up a small fund on which these grassroots organizations can draw direct. They bring a proposal. They can get between £10,000 and £50,000 to support the initiatives that they choose. They review each other's proposals. These are things that meet their needs. You know, getting land, building 200 homes, building a community toilet. Thank you. But it also shows local government what they're capable of. The key to me is where urban poor groups can make local government see them as people with knowledge, with capacity, with innovation. Working together, they can achieve so much more. They visit each other. The photo is actually in Namibia, and it's a Sri Lankan community leader walking with a Namibian community leader, because all these federations visit each other, talk to each other, work with each other. We gave those 300 Harare women the $18,000 loan they needed, and they bought the land, and they built homes, and it now houses 300 households, 2,000 people. I got 5 proposals of marriage when I visited them because they thought that I had provided the funding out of my own pocket. And they're keeping a plot for me for my retirement. Hence my comment about getting marriage proposals. I don't have time to talk about just how much this small urban poor fund has supported, but you get a sense of the scale and the range of what it's supported. You know, land for housing, some amazingly good quality housing built by the federations. Upgrading, bridge finance for when a government commits itself to work with them, but the money is slow to come. Improved water and sanitation, often with improved tenure. Enumerations of their homes and their neighborhoods. If you provide enumerations to local government and maps, it's much easier to actually design upgrading schemes. Most of the informal settlements I work in, there's no maps. No one goes there. There's no survey. So the federations are producing the maps and the enumerations and the census data, which allow them to become incorporated into formal networks of infrastructure. The exchange visits. They visit each other. They learn from each other. They celebrate each other's successes. My last two slides. Funding the federations direct means that tens of thousands of low-income people can have their needs met with very modest funding. The projects they implement set precedents, and it's around those precedents that they show local government what they're capable of, and they bring in local government to real partnership. They also show what has to be changed. There's very often building codes have to be changed, minimum plot sizes have to be changed, infrastructure standards have to be changed to bring down prices, so that low-income groups can get into the formal market for land, and so on, and so on. The $7 or $8 million that this fund has provided has leveraged so much more locally. And to me, it shows the feasibility of a new funding model where the funders have a direct relationship with the urban poor and their organizations. There's other examples for this. Those that have time, Google on the Asian Coalition for Community Action. It's an amazing, similar initiative to our Urban Poor Fund International going on throughout. So in conclusion, international agencies need to think what role they should have in encouraging and supporting local processes that reduce poverty. Very difficult for them to do. There's lots of them. Many of them are not very expensive. The funding, the managing the funding for thousands of small community-driven initiatives is not an easy logistic thing. Of course, it doesn't mean that nothing should be done at national and international level. But if just 1% of development assistance was at the disposal of urban poor groups, I think we would change dramatically our capacity to improve health and to reduce poverty. Thank you.